the sixth class on active hope. How to face the mess we're in without going crazy, by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. Is there anybody here who has no idea what this is about?
I have an idea.
I mean, you know, because this is the first of these classes that you've come to. Well, I'm not going to do the spiel that I've done for the last five classes. I may return to that next time. But I kind of... I don't know. It's always difficult for me anyway to commit to a whole book. Because partway through, I might just... I mean, how... You know, as a teacher, I'm like, I don't know. You know, how is it being met? Is it useful? Are people connecting with it? I don't know. And even if they're not connecting with it, do I think they should? And therefore, I go through with it anyway. You know, like that kind of... judgment. And I don't know, maybe it's just me, but partway through books, I start to get kind of nervous that everybody's getting bored and wants to do something else. But so I just kind of went back to square one as I was preparing for this, just thinking, what do I think, what do I want to say? The chapter this week, which we will talk about and deal with to a certain extent, is a richer experience of community. So this is one of the ways that we cultivate active hope, which is focusing on working for what we hope for in the world, as opposed to hopefulness that things are going to turn out the way that we would like. So I just wanted to why are we doing this? Why are we focusing on this book? And I just thought I would start with kind of my story. When I was a kid, I was very troubled by the state of the world. My life was fine, but... and I ended up... 10, 15 years ago, I wrote this poem about that called Right and Wrong. So much wrong. They said there were enough bombs to destroy the whole planet. But I had only just discovered kangaroos. My dad held me perfectly in a bear hug, so I knew I was beautiful and capable of anything. But the girl who threatened me in the school bathroom didn't think so. My childhood was warm and smelled of my mother's homemade bread. But in National Geographic, the kids had stomachs the size of basketballs. I didn't know whether to fight or flee this world, whether to take a taste of it and let its juices stream down all over me, or to cut out the tongue that might betray me with its lust and leave me bound and obligated. So I carried a fierce motto everywhere, clenched in my fists, but at last I'm too exhausted. We still demand justice, the kangaroos, the little kids, and me. But I have not cut out my tongue, and my hunger binds me to the fate of the world. So growing up, I wanted to go into a career that would have significant impact on changing the world for the better. So I went into science. I had some aptitude for that. I studied wildlife biology because I thought ecosystems and wildlife, protecting them would be very important. And I was really just, how could I just enjoy my life when there was so much suffering? So it was just this strange cognitive dissonance and emotional disconnect. Eventually I decided against a career in wildlife. Although I finished my master's, because right about that time, I entered postulancy for monastic ordination, because the practice, the difference that practice and my sangha and my teachers had made in my life seemed like more of an impact. Like, if I could be involved in that, that was more of a direct impact on the world than, I don't know, there's nothing like going to grad school to figure out what you don't want to do. And you just begin to see how complicated it is and how competitive it was going to be and how I was going to spend, you know, decades trying to prove some small thing that then was just going to be ignored in terms of policy. I mean, we're already ignoring a huge amount that we know in terms of policy, so it was just sort of like, I don't want it, just don't feel motivated. So I ordained instead. And over the years of practice, I saw how my real, not just material, my real happiness and peace of mind actually benefited the world. That I was not helping the world by walking around under a cloud. I was not, you know, my just being miserable on behalf of the world was actually just weighing me down and paralyzing me, not making me helpful at all. So then I kind of gave myself permission to have some ease and peace of mind. And then over time, I learned a deeper frame of reference where everything is fundamentally precious just as it is, no matter what happens. And that, you know, that kind of practice over the course of many years relieved my suffering. And then I spent a number of years establishing this Zen center and myself as a teacher, so there was lots to do, and it's kind of like, you know, the era of like raising your family and, you know. But in the last 5 or 6 years, I've been turning back to this question of how to respond to the suffering in the world. And I see how easy it is to get just engrossed in my everyday, still comfortable and pleasant life, not really making any real sacrifices in my response to the suffering in the world and of the earth, not actually living according to my conscience, getting discouraged before acting because such and such action doesn't seem worth the sacrifice of my time and energy. It doesn't seem like it's going to have a big enough impact. So when I encountered this book, probably about 5 years ago, it was the best and most useful thing I had found. It really just gave me a different way to relate to the whole question and the whole idea of action and the whole idea of community and looking at our crisis or crises as opportunities. So, and the idea that not only is doing something, we need everybody to help, we need everyone's help, but also it ends up being the best medicine for our souls. Which this chapter in particular, this deeper experience, a richer experience of community, really demonstrated. And still, it took me 5 years to bring this book into the Zendo. And even so, I did it with trepidation, kind of like, I don't know, it's this, what if people don't want to study this? What if it doesn't seem relevant? What if people stop coming and leave? And that's like, you know, when you're nurturing a sangha, or when you belong to a sangha, people leaving the sangha is a bad thing. Like, you don't want people to leave the sangha. You know, that's like your community. So you don't want to alienate people or anything. It'd be a huge source of sadness. And yet, I also don't feel like I can just give up and talk only about Buddhism in the abstract, or only how it relates to our personal daily lives. I mean, we gotta talk about that. We'll talk about that, certainly. But I really believe we are headed for a great unraveling. And the only question is how soon it will come and how quickly it will get difficult for us. Is it 10 years away, 20, 30? Will it be visited on the next generation? And yet that latter, that idea, will it be visited on the next generation, is actually a fallacy, because it's being visited on a whole bunch of people right now. So I won't go on and on, but just a few sobering facts. Over 50% of the human addition of carbon to the atmosphere through the burning of fossil fuels has occurred in the last 25 years, since the International Panel on Climate Change was formed. Globally, the past 4 years have been the hottest on record, and the 20 warmest have occurred in the past 22 years. The latest Living Planet Index shows an average decline of 60% in population sizes of thousands of vertebrate species around the world between 1970 and 2014. A 27-year-long population monitoring study in Germany revealed a dramatic 76% decline in flying insect biomass. 50% of the planet's topsoil has been lost in the last 150 years, leading to increased pollution, flooding, and desertification. And as we know, much of the migration causing a rise in racism and nationalism and populism is driven by environmental stuff exacerbated by climate change. So tonight's chapter is about a richer experience of community and basically how powerful and wonderful it is when we come together. And they talk about in smaller groups where we feel at home, in the wider community around us, in the global community, and then in like the community of the earth itself, you know, beyond humankind. And really, the more material wealth and independence we have, the less we need to rely on one another. So coming together in this way is often in response to crisis and need. So I'll just read you a few excerpts from the chapter about this. Rebecca Solnit, in her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, describes a case where the isolation and mutual indifference so prevalent in modern society gets swept away. So she says, I landed in Halifax, Nova Scotia, shortly after a big hurricane tore up the city in October of 2003. The man in charge of taking me around told me about the hurricane, not about the winds that roared at more than 100 miles an hour and tore up trees, roofs, and telephone poles, or about the seas that rose nearly 10 feet, but about the neighbors. He spoke of the few days when everything was so disrupted, and he lit up with happiness as he did so. In his neighborhood, all the people had come out of their houses to speak with each other, aid each other, improvise a community kitchen, make sure the elders were okay, and spend time together, no longer strangers. So this is Macy and Johnstone again. Our human tendency to pull together in emergency situations, even to risk our lives helping others, is well documented. In her study of human responses to disasters, Solnit describes how such rising to the occasion is more common than many suspect and more satisfying than many might imagine. Referring to her own experience of an earthquake in San Francisco Bay Area in 1989, and the gratifying engagement she noticed in herself and others afterward, she writes, that sense of immersion in the moment and solidarity with others caused by the rupture in everyday life, an emotion graver than happiness but deeply positive. We don't even have a language for this emotion, in which the wonderful comes wrapped in the terrible, joy and sorrow, courage and fear. We cannot welcome disaster, but we can value the responses, both practical and psychological. Disasters provide an extraordinary window into social desire and possibility. And then here's an example of not a community, not just responding to disaster, though. A free booklet produced by the Transition United States describes some simple initiatives that build community and save energy. One is the walking school bus that has children walking to school in groups with one or more adults. This can be as informal as two or three families taking turns, or it can be more structured with scheduled routes and trained volunteers. Another example is PermaBlitz, in which groups come together to transform one another's back or front yards into gardens for growing food. Skills are shared, friends are made, and hard work is done with mutual enjoyment. And then finally, this is a sociologist, I think, who was visiting Ladakh in 1975. And she was told by one of the villagers, so this was a very, you know, I guess third world, whatever you want to call it, undeveloped area. When she first visited in 1975, she was told by one of the villagers, "We don't have any poor people here." She thought he was speaking the truth. Everyone's basic needs certainly appeared well met. There were no very rich people either, not in the material way at least. In terms of social capital, though, the Ladakhi were among the wealthiest people she had ever known and the happiest. They would sing together while bringing in the harvest. Their peacefulness was infectious. A phrase she kept hearing the villagers say was, "We have to live together." When a conflict arose, they would repeat this like a mantra and find a way of getting on. What would it be like if this were our mantra too? So, rather than talk about community in the abstract, I wanted to practice some connecting with community directly tonight. So I want to do a council circle where we will pass the talking stick around, and each person is invited to say something. But you don't have to. If you just want to pass, you can just hold the stick in silence for a while if you want, or you can pass it on. We'll probably go around once, and if we still have time, it will just be put in the middle, and if anybody has anything additional they want to say, they can pick it up. So, essentially, I'm learning as I go. I'm learning a lot, helping to, you know, run a Zen center, if you will, and I'm also getting involved in some social action work where the emphasis really is on collaboration and horizontal structure, and so it just occurred to me that, like, there's this awkwardness of, like, here I am as the teacher trying to decide how, as a Sangha, we should address our crisis. How do we look at it? How often do we mention it? How do we hold it? How do we bring our practice to bear on it? How do we support one another in facing what's going on while still maintaining perspective, joy, humor, appreciation for life? How do we break out of the sense of dualisms, spiritual versus social action, or my life versus everybody else's life, or our community's well-being versus the community of the rest, the well-being of the rest of the community? I mean, you know, 10, 20, 30, whatever years from now, if things get very, very difficult, we want to look back and be like, yeah, I was part of a Buddhist community, and we just kind of kept meditating, trying to, you know, cope with our feelings of being bummed out. But, or do we want to have somehow found a way for our Sangha and our practice to more directly meet what is going on? So I will describe the process, but the question, which you can just have let rattle around in your head at the moment, is how can you imagine our Sangha coming together in this time of crisis? not limited to what necessarily is practical or whatever. Whatever arises for you in response to that. And really, when you have a seed question like that in the council process, it's also people can, we can go off script if people want to say something else. It has a life of its own. So in council process, the idea is that everything is horizontal. I mean, to some extent, I know people are uncomfortable with this kind of thing, so I probably won't ask us to move chairs, but on the other hand, it is a little awkward that I'm sitting here like this. When we join in council process, everybody is equal. I am speaking simply from my own experience. You are speaking from simply your own experience. And speaking from your heart about your own experience, thoughts, and feelings. So one thing I heard in a training was stash your soapbox. And also, we don't comment on the reflections of others, so that we all feel safe to just say what's coming up for us, and nobody is going to tell us we're wrong or should think otherwise or something like that. And it's not about solving anything. It has a value in and of itself. And whatever comes up in council stays in council unless you ask somebody later for permission to talk about it, talk about, you know, what they said with them. So, I will do mine. Oh yeah, maybe somebody's willing to start and then we'll go clockwise. And keep in mind that if you're not ready or you don't have something you want to say, just pass it along to the next person. Yeah.
Daniel, could you repeat the question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
How can you imagine our Sangha coming together in this time of crisis? And in a way, I don't want to say more than that because then I'm kind of shaping your answer, but if you imagine our Sangha as like these communities that she was describing, that really came together in a positive way. And that's what I've found so far in my own actions, that, you know, how do we face what's going on and still maintain perspective, joy, humor, appreciation? That kind of comes with the community. That kind of comes with the doing. Yeah.
Just that you at least relocate yourself, even if you were to sit on that cushion up there, so that you're not in your traditional.
Yeah, and maybe I'll sit in a chair, seeing as most people are sitting in chairs, and maybe we could just peel the sides in just a little bit. And seeing as this is going to be on the speaker,
it's not recording.
Yeah. So if you could stop the recording, Bob.
That's not okay. You turned it off the recording.
It's only 9 after 9, not too bad. Thank you everyone for speaking from the heart, and I feel like we just scratched the surface. There's a lot more that could be said. But before I should leave it at that so I'm not just messing up the council process. So we should do a closing of, we offer the merit of this council process to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha parajna paramita.